everyone. I'm Steve Coleman, for those that are just now joining us. And I thought maybe it's a little bit appropriate to kind of take a step back and just, in case some folks are here that just want to learn what's going on with Perennial Greens and what the work is, I'll just give kind of a very biased overview in terms of what's happened in the last, say, 20 years or so. But really, this is work that was envisioned. I mean, university accredited Wes Jackson as his kind of brainchild, this idea of developing agricultural systems that look like and mimic natural systems. So using tallgrass prairie as an example and moving to a kind of a perennial polyculture model, right? And so that's a long ways away in terms of actually getting there, if we ever do get there. There's a number of crops that have been working with that have been worked on for a number of years now, but it's really just been in the last 10 years that funding and a lot of philanthropic money that Lantu has been able to raise to really kind of jumpstart this. And then this collaboration with Minnesota has been very key. And so really in the last 5 years, there's just been like a tripling or quadrupling in the work. Wouldn't you say, Jake? It's just like what's happened. And the other major shift is that a lot of that preliminary work was focused on breeding, right? As it should. I mean, breeding is still our number one priority, and it's by far the germplasm isn't ready for big time yet. But it's also this recognition that these are going to be very different things than annual row crop systems. And in the case of intermediate wheatgrass, which Jake was just talking about, which I'm going to talk about, this is a highly rhizomatous sod-forming plant. And so it's almost like we're managing a hay field for grain. So there's a lot of different things to think about. And I think it really underscores the importance of not selecting yield, you know, not in these single-spaced plants, which is currently done, but thinking about a management by genetic by environment interaction. So it's complicated. This is, you know, there's no, you'll see, I mean, if you just saw Jake's talk, we're still scratching the surface in terms of basic agronomic things like how much nitrogen does it need, you know, and is that response consistent? So, yeah. Any comments or questions on that before I move on to this stuff? Great. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm at Ohio State. I'm a soil fertility specialist at Ohio State. I haven't been there very long, but when I got there, I have had some experience working with this Kernza, this intermediate wheatgrass. The reason it's called Kernza, because intermediate wheatgrass is not a not a good word for a new thing you're trying to roll out and get people excited about. It's like, why is it intermediate? Well, don't worry about that. Is it wheatgrass? I mean, isn't that the stuff you juice and, like, you know? It's like, no. Just let's move on. So Kernza is this name, right? And so, you know, similar to we've got canola now in Canada, and that was just a manufactured name that was, you know, for the product development of rape. And so Kernza is kind of what the Land Institute has settled on. So this work that I'm going to talk about is a collective work. I realize I should have, shame on me, I should have put acknowledged a lot of authors up here, which I haven't, but we'll get to that in a second. So Jake gave a nice introduction. You know, for those of you that know me, every stinking talk I've ever given on Kernza has this slide, because it's just really dramatic in terms of, you know, we have this very above-ground bias, right? We see, not only do we only see what's going on above the soil, but we very commonly only measure things above the soil because it's a whole lot easier to do that. But the reality is that, or the idea, the concept here is that just this rooting system fundamentally changes what we're talking about in energy and nutrient dynamics and cycling and resource allocation and use that goes on below ground. And so this is kind of the focus. And then there's a whole lot of messy details about how to actually do it, right? About how to grow it, how to breed for it, and it's an exciting group to be a part of, because it's really uncharted territory in terms of from the breeding, from the agronomy, and everything else. Okay, It's a very productive grass. You saw Jake's data on par with switchgrass, at least for the first few years. There's other studies that have shown that too. This is just a shot in Michigan. First year, this is like it was planted, say, in October, and then this is a shot right before heading, early May, something like that. So very productive grass. This is what the seed heads look like. Very small seeds, very challenging to work with. You know, there are lots of issues here. They shatter easily. They don't thresh very, very well. So there's a lot of traits that they could select for. But really, the primary thing is seed size and yield. That's kind of what occupies the majority of the breeding efforts at this point. This is what the seed looks like, and you know, seed heads when they're dried down. So, and I will mention this is really there's maybe two main approaches that we can take in terms of trying to develop perennial grain crops. So there's a straight domestication, which is what this crop, what's going on here, and then there's a hybridization approach where they're crossing, say, an annual wheat with a wild relative to try to create some hybrids. So they both have pluses and minuses. The only thing we're talking about today is kind of this domestication. And what's great about this is that it's a lot more consistent in terms of knowing what you've got, right? You take two somewhat related, an annual and a perennial, and you mash them together, and it's very inconsistent in terms of perenniality, yield, what the phenotype looks like, how much it regrows. And so in the context of the work as it stands right now, you know, it's almost like we'll deal with low yields, but consistency, right? Because nothing's going to drive farmer disadoption rates like planting something out, thinking it's perennial. They come back in the spring after the first year, and then we've got 60% ground cover or something. You know, 40% of plants have not come back. So, okay. So Jake just showed you some grain yield data. Typically, this is a low yielding crop, right? We're usually talking about less than a ton per hectare per year. That's 15 bushels of wheat, right? I mean, this is, and you think about, well, at least in our environments in the Midwest, it's not, you know, we're talking 80 to 110 bushel wheat would be pretty typical. And you go out in the Palouse and it's much greater than that even. So very low yielding crop. This is a major concern. But the reality is that thinking of this as a dual use, can we manage it as a grain, but also get a forage crop out of that? And so we believe, or I believe at least, that livestock producers are a primary, we need an animal in the system to make it work economically, right? It's just not going to work without an animal. And we've got a couple of them right over there. We've got issues with declining yields and stands, so stand longevity. My numbers are messed up. Yeah, it's funny. Nitrogen, you know, it's not corn. We can't just apply more nitrogen and then we see a response. It doesn't work that way. We've got lodging issues and other things. So Jake had that was very good in terms of that introduction. So some of the basic questions that I think still need to be addressed are, can we offset the slow grain production with the added value of a forage? Okay, so is that a reality? I mean, conceptually it makes sense, but what is actually defoliation or haying or grazing due to the plant and due to the grain yields? Productivity over time, and then, you know, this is an interesting one, reducing competition between plants via reducing tiller density. So I've actually observed two phenomena where you get an incredible amount of tiller density and really low yields, and really low tiller density and really low yields. So I believe it's likely going to be some sort of optimization. But how do we manage this plant to optimize reproductive tillers, or, you know, i.e. seed heads? Specifically in this context, for this study, the idea is just to grow Kernza a number of different environments and record what it actually does. I mean, Jake just showed his data. In Minnesota, but what if we scale up and get, you know, to warmer places, drier places? And so that's one of the primary objectives of what we're trying to do here. And then to determine how defoliation, and that's a catch-all term for grazing or a haying, you know, simulated disturbance event. How does that influence grain yields, plant height, dry matter, and forage quality? Okay, so the study design, there was a true no-cut control, which means that all you do is you go through and you combine and take the grain off, okay, and then you leave everything lay there. And then there's a control where you do that exact same thing but remove that vast 10, 11, 12 tons of forage after that grain removal. A spring cut and a fall cut, the spring cut is an early, what would be kind of a simulated early graze. Now, there's no animals in any of this. This is all just, you know, mechanical defoliation clipping. So a spring plus summer and then a fall plus summer. So trying to manipulate both the timing and the frequency of that defoliation. I'm not going to talk about everything, but there is an end rate in some of the sites. There was some irrigation in some of the sites, some intercropping, row spacing. There's a number of different things that we're just not going to get into today. So this is my acknowledgement slide. You probably can't even read it. 2015, we had, I think there, let's just count, 2, 4, 6, 8 sites that were planted. Seven sites, I guess. It's Beltsville, Maryland. So you can see that where we're at. We're going from Colorado to Michigan, and then as far east as Maryland and New York. And then last year we had a couple new collaborators come on at Iowa, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and Alberta. And so Jamie Larson in Alberta is another fellow that's working not with Kernza that much, but with perennial rye. So it's kind of the same, different crop, of course, but it's like the same idea in terms of managing for both a grain and a forage. So there we go. Spring grazing, this is something that's an interesting concept that we're interested in it because if we graze, we've just anecdotal evidence that if we graze, we can actually lower, reduce plant height. And then that might help with the lodging issue, which is a major limitation. But it's a little bit like playing with fire because, you know, if you clip, it's actually pretty difficult to feel that palpable node when it's coming up through the growing point. And if you clip it when it's too late and clip that growing point off, you're just not going to get nearly the yield. So it's a risky endeavor, but that's, you know, one of the things we wanted to do. Here, we just simulated with a lawnmower. So, I mean, just paid to get cut grass, right? You can see in this picture, this is the second year. This is just this summer, or this spring. This is our no-cut control. And I'm not going to show data here, but it's like, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. Because you just have all this biomass sitting on top of each other. And you know, it just wrecks it. So that's a system. So to commit, if you're a grower, to commit to plant to this, you need some way to remove that biomass. I mean, that's certainly could be a barrier to adoption. So this is kind of the spring clip treatment that we did. This is what it looks like at harvest. And so again, I'll show you forage data in a second, but you can see quite a bit of biomass there. Okay, so determining range, just what do we got? Like, what's this thing capable of doing, okay? So I don't have all the sites in here. We're still getting some. This is an unfunded project, and so, you know, with all unfunded projects, we have to be cognizant that a lot of times this is not everybody's first priority, but we got there's clearly a lot of interest and good buy-in here. The different panels are different sites, different colors are the different years. Here's that 1-ton mark, and so you can see the variability. All of this is actually quadrat data. We tried to get plot data with combines. Some sites had a hard time doing that, so we've just standardized this. And all the data that you're going to see is quadrat data for, you know, for whatever it's worth. So I'm not sure the average is that meaningful. You can see how much variability we've got across these sites. Everybody knows what these states are, right? There's two sites in Ohio. I guess I don't have to explain that. 700 kilograms, so we're less than a ton. That's basically, we're talking like eight bushels of grain for the first year, and then the second year, even less than that. Of course, we're talking, if we think back about in the Midwest, we've had two very dry summers back to back now. So I believe we can do better than this, but we just need a little bit better. We need better weather for that to happen. An interesting observation across all sites, we counted seed head numbers, so the number of seed heads in that quadrat. Grain yield seems to be pretty related to number of seed heads in there. There's certainly not this, but we also see this kind of the variation like scattering as it moves out. So if there's a breeder in here, they might be able to tell me what that means. I don't really, just interesting. So, can we manage plant height and reduce lodging with a spring clip? Okay, and so all this is just data 2015, 2016, the two different sites, this SP, which is the spring clip, it's the red, and then the green is the summer clip. So that's what I just called control, right? So it's the summer only versus the clip. So that's what we're seeing, and for the most part, we see these letters, statistical difference. You know, clipping reduces plant height. This is plant height on the y-axis here. But does that lead to lower yields, okay? So we can see that clipping generally reduces the actual height of that plant. Does that lead to lower yields? And there's, you know, it's not the most complete data set here, but there's just really one instance of this happening, and it's at this Iowa site, okay? So pretty consistent. It's consistent as we, you know, for reducing that stature, but then in terms of reducing yield, not very consistent differences in terms of the effect of that. Does defoliation affect grain yields? Okay, so here's a little bit more similar data, but broken out into the three primary defoliation. So our control, again, that's just that at summer, you harvest that grain at summer, then you remove that biomass. That's what I'm calling control in this slide. Then there's the spring and the fall. Okay, so you can look at that. If there's letters there, then they're statistically different. Okay, so again, not much evidence that defoliation, that our treatments after 2 years, this is only 2 years of data, but not much evidence that we're seeing, you know, we're not seeing any trends in terms of declining yields based on this clipping removal. I was going to show you some forage data, but I skipped over that. I must have. I did skip over it. Here it is. So this is forage yield data. Jake's sites were somewhere around 10 to 12 tons on average over those 2 years. And that third year, it dropped down to about 8. Was that what I remember? Okay. So we can see over these environments quite a bit less even than that. I mean, so we're talking about really half that. And this is a plant that we've kind of anecdotally seen in Kansas in hotter environments. There's a lot. It's sensitive to heat. And so probably Michigan, Ithaca, New York, these are probably environments where we might think it's the most favorable for this crop. So I did want to show just some forage. And we have forage data from the spring clips and the fall clips, but I'm not going to show any of that. We're wrapping up. So, okay, so preliminary findings is that, hey, agronomy, yields vary across environments, right? Like, we got that. Yep, check that out. It's great. You can we can do the same things that we've been doing for like decades and decades and still talk about it, right? Control treatments yielded less grain, so that's just like a busted system, and you need to remove those. I didn't show that data, but it's not that exciting. It's just it doesn't work. So maybe in terms of a slight management implication, that clipping did consistently reduce plan height. Did it have impacts on lodging? Well, lodging can be very, I didn't show lodging data because it's very inconsistent when it does happen. So it's kind of like, can be, might happen 80% of the time, or 80, one out of, sorry, not 80% of the time, might happen only 20% of the time, but when it happens, it's a big deal. So not enough observations to really have any kind of conclusion about that. And then our preliminary results just suggesting over these sites that that we can take forage off and have it not influence that grain yield. So that's all I have. Thanks for your time. I'd be happy to take questions.
Two questions, and maybe this was covered by the previous speaker. I came in a little late. Sure. But what is Kernza used for, and what is the seed, and what is its value?
Great. Yeah, it's a great question. Like all newly developing crops, there's many more questions than answers. Right now, Jake showed a slide of this long root beer, which is a beer that's brewed in Portland, and so that's kind of like the first real commercial implementation of that. And it can be used. It's not gluten free, but it doesn't have any of the gluten that that we think about that we need for bread. I've learned that gluten is very complicated. Talk to a food scientist. So you can mix it. Blend it. There's folks. I've got folks. Specialty bakers that are interested in this in Ohio that they will blend it. Maybe a 50-50 blend and make pizzas with it, or all kinds of stuff. So waffle. I've had Kernza of waffles, scones, cookies, pancakes. There are lots of different things. So we believe I hate to disappoint, but I tried to get my miller to finish some up so we could actually have some cookies for the symposium. I mean, how good would that have been? But it's delicious. It's a grain. You can substitute it like flour. There's been a lot of product testing that's going on. Minnesota is doing a lot of work with General Mills right now in terms of product development. People are interested in it, from a food perspective, I don't know what they call those folks, food industry perspective, they're very interested in another new thing that can be value added. And so we're in an environment where we obviously have food consumers that are willing to pay good premiums on a lot of things, and we think that this could feed right into that. But other than that, we don't have any realistic economics of what it actually costs to produce. But right now, the demand is far in excess of the supply. There's probably a couple hundred, maybe 300-400 acres in the U.S. right now. So it's, the idea is to continue to build it up and plant more acres. But Tara. Jake, University of Wisconsin and Minnesota just were awarded a North Central Sarah grant, and to actually put real live animals on it, right? What are you going to be looking at? Right, yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that I didn't show data for, but that we believe that the fall grazing, the spring grazing is attractive in terms of addressing the lodging issue, but the fall grazing is really when you get much more biomass. So I showed the picture of that llamaing. That's obviously not a whole lot of biomass, but in the spring we get regrowth, given sufficient rain, there's a decent amount of regrowth that happens that could be grazed. So that's going to be the primary, and that's a much more wide window in terms of when they could graze that. Probably a 6 week or more window after harvest, so before you want to take them off.
Is there any preliminary data on soil quality associated with it, or kind of even
a plot? Jenny's doing some of that with her master's thesis. We've published just a little bit of from a study in Michigan that looked at. We basically, after 4 years, what's published right now is 2 years. We're working on the other two, writing that up. But tremendous amount of reduction in nitrate leaching in these systems, not surprisingly, relative to annual wheat. We saw significant increases in a respiration, that 24-hour burst respiration method. So there has been some work, not a whole lot, but, you know, I mean, we've got lots of course, data studies that have looked at perennial forage systems versus, and in many ways, I think it's not too far of a stretch to assume that those sort of benefits would confer in these systems as well. Yeah, it's a great question. I didn't mention that. 80 pounds of mostly urea per acre is a split applied right at green up in the spring and then right after grain harvest. So that's what we just kind of settled on. 80 pounds, 80 kilograms per acre, whatever, is probably, from our work, we've found that that's not far off in terms of what might be needed. So if you plant into a very high fertility environment and you apply nitrogen, we've done an N-rate in Michigan too, and very some sites very little response to nitrogen. So. Great question. I don't have intention of doing this. This Kearns is probably the one that's most ready for prime time right now. There's other work being done with silphium, which is a related to a sunflower plant. There's work with, of course, perennial wheat. That was, you know, that's a lot of that work. There's work in perennial rye and barley right now. Perennial rice, there's a very fruitful, active group of scientists in China that are working on this. What am I missing? Sunflower is kind of on the table. Alfalfa is on the table. So there's a number of things that people are looking at. Yeah.
What's the nutrient value of all that forage that's being produced?
Yeah,
whatever.
Right. I mean, so we have forage quality data. We haven't dug into it too much. I don't know if you have, Jake, but it's. You know, this is in the Intermountain West. This is a grass. Intermediate wheatgrass is grown commonly for grazing. So places like Idaho, places like Utah. This is a primary forage grass. People like it there because it is responsive to inputs. If you irrigate, say you've got just maybe enough irrigation for a half a year or one grazing, then you can put water on it. You can typically put fertility on it, and it will respond to that. It's like just the leaf itself. It's a little bit coarser textured leaf than some of the, you know, the king cool season grasses that we find in the West, like fescue or orchard grass. It's a little bit lower quality than that, but it's still very respectable. You know, it's classified as a highly palatable, high VAT feed value grass, especially for the Great Plains and Intermountain West regions. Yeah. All right, well, thanks, everybody.